Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. New projections show $4.4 billion in unexpected revenue growth over the next 2 years. News that led one top Republican to call for $4 billion in tax cuts.
The vast majority, if not all, of the money should really go toward paying down people's taxes.
The Joint Finance Committee continued its work on the budget, approving nearly $1.5 billion in building projects. And Republicans in the Assembly and Senate passed a bill to end enhanced unemployment benefits for Wisconsinites. Rewind, your week in review. For June 11th.
Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is seeking up to $4 billion in tax cuts following unprecedented collections. New estimates released this week show Wisconsin is expected to see $4.4 billion in additional revenue through mid-2023. The projections show the state will end the current fiscal year with a $2.6 billion surplus, $816.1 million more than previously thought. Following the announcement, Governor Evers reversed the $250 million in state agency cuts he directed in September for 2020-2021. That includes $45 million for the University of Wisconsin system. Assembly Speaker Voss told reporters after a meeting with leader Devin Lemahieu he wants to see, quote, the largest possible tax cut, but said the method was still under discussion. JR, the picture just keeps getting rosier, doesn't it? LFP's Bob Lang this week said, or called the increase in tax collections in April and May of 2021 unprecedented, and based on those plus economic forecasts, said that there would be this $4.4 billion revenue estimate, right? How is this news going to shape the rest of the budget process?
Well, a couple things. One, it's going to make the tax cut discussion a little bit more interesting. A couple things to remember. So in January, we were going to have about $1.85 billion for a surplus and growth of $1 billion over the next 2 years. In 3 months, we went from that, which is a pretty good picture, to $4.4 billion more than we thought we were going to have just 3 months ago. And there are two things that really have changed, according to Lang's memo. One, the President Biden signing the American Rescue Plan Act. And two, things get better with COVID. So number of cases are down, vaccinations are going all right, restrictions are being lifted. It's supercharging the economy. So, and you know, things are getting better in general. So we've known for a while that Republicans in the state on the Joint Finance Committee have been looking at how they do a tax cut. What kind of tax cut they do? They're gonna put money into Medicaid, which is gonna up on Tuesday before finance, and then do a tax cut. Well, now the options for tax cut are pretty interesting. So you have, for example, some Republicans have been on a push about property taxes for years, largely inspired by Governor Scott Walker. They call it buying down the levy. You take formulas where there's a mix of state tax dollars and local property taxes to pay for a service or for schools. The more state money you put in, the less property taxes locals can raise. It buys down the levy. The challenge with that is, with schools especially, every time they would do it, the locals would do a referendum and eat that property tax back up. Dale Kuyenga, Republican in the Finance Committee, who's been on military duty lately, he's got a bill to collapse on the tax brackets and the income tax structure in Wisconsin. That's going to get some chatter. There's a segment of the Senate Republican Caucus talks about personal property tax. Every time there's money, they talk about getting rid of the personal property tax. That is if you're a business and you have like a restaurant with ovens, for example, you get taxed on the equipment that you have. So they want to get rid of that. That would require, though, backfilling the lost revenue for local governments. There's money to do that right now. Then you're going to have people in the Republican caucuses who what about structural deficit, which is basically when you make a commitment into future years that exceeds what you have in current revenue, right? So the more money you keep on hand in the general fund, the less the structural deficit is. Rob Coles, for example, from Green Bay, Republican senator, he's always talked about structural deficits. So you're going to have all the competing interests coming to a head by Thursday. Now, we hope by Thursday, not by Friday morning, but sometime Thursday we hope to see what the tax package could be. And I've talked to the Republicans are going to work all weekend on trying to figure out a deal. So it may not be that bad, but we're at crunch time. And so it's going to be a question of who's going to blink. If there's a standoff, who's going to blink? Another thing to keep in mind, there is this thing hanging out there about the maintenance of effort with the federal money for schools, right? So it's $2.2 billion in change through the last two federal COVID packages. To meet that get that money, you have to put a maintenance of effort, which basically means you maintain spending your general purpose revenue at the same level, same share of your overall spending as it was these previous years. Yesterday, Bob Lang, the director of Fiscal Bureau, said it would be $430 million more in general purpose revenue to schools than what we were at previously. That price tag goes up if they spend more GPR on Medicaid on Tuesday. However, there's a little silver lining here for Republicans. You can drive down property taxes by putting more money into schools through the formula by not raising the cap on how much you can spend per kid. So again, those formulas, there's a cap when you spend per student in Wisconsin based on state revenue and property taxes. The more state revenue you get as a district, the less you can raise in property taxes. You could, in theory, drive a bunch of GPR in that formula, lower property taxes, meet the maintenance effort requirement, and make it harder for Governor Evers to veto that budget when it gets on his desk sometime end of June, early July.
Yeah, I want to return back to this income tax discussion that you sort of opened the door to when you were talking about Cuenca, a member of the CPA caucus,
yes.
Of course, we should note. So he, a couple years ago, had pushed to sort of move Wisconsin gradually towards a flat income tax, I think of 3.95% by 2029 or something like that. Do you expect that discussion will continue to gather steam as we're looking at these revenue estimates and having this conversation?
I haven't heard about a flat tax. It's been more about the Cuenca bill that would collapse one of the brackets. And so when you do with the collapse of bracket is you have income cutoffs, right? So you make X thousand dollars, everybody, doesn't matter if you make 100 grand or 10 grand, the first segment of your income is taxed at this level. And the next segment at this level. And then on, if you collapse a bracket, it helps everybody, but it's geared toward the lower income level. It kind of combats the argument about, you know, it benefits the rich because it benefits everybody who's below that level of income. That seems like an easy way to do the income tax cut, but we'll see. There are 12 Republicans on that committee. There are two co-chairs, and there are also leaders that they report to. So they could have a lot of ideas between now and Thursday about what they want to do with that money.
Right, and Cuenca has touted that approach as a way to benefit the middle class, including mm-hmm. in statements this week, so we'll see how that goes. I do want to mention sort of the history that we've had with tax cuts recently under divided government. So obviously there was a tax cut passed in the 2019-21 biennial budget. Mm-hmm. There's a year after that, a $250 million income tax cut that Republicans floated and Evers vetoed. And then, of course, Evers has sought to end sort of the manufacturing portion of the man and egg tax credit, raise capital gains, things like that. Where do you think Evers is on, I guess, tax cuts more broadly? Is there more some he's inclined to and others he's not inclined to support?
Remember we talked last week about the governor saying that veto is on the table because this budget, the investment in education was paltry, an insult to students, right? His red lines have been Medicaid expansion and more money for schools. Well, if they put more money into schools in next week and they give him a big, massive tax cut, how does he say no when he's running for election next fall, knowing that they won't do another budget? I mean, that's been the line for Republicans is this is going to be our last final offer. Maybe the governor can say, call their bluff, say, I think they'll come back and do something else if they don't meet me halfway. He can go run against a do-nothing legislature that refuses to work with me, refuses to expand Medicaid, refuses to legalize medical marijuana or marijuana in general. I mean, there are ways he could pull it off if he's messaging it properly. But it gets awfully tough the more they put into schools and the bigger the tax cut is to say no when you've got that reelection hanging out there next fall. So there's still I've asked people, they've been talking about will he veto, will he won't. There's still a path if he really wanted to do it, but it gets tougher with what he's talking about. So the governor, he signed an individual income tax cut in 2019. There also was that whole package about redirecting sales tax into an income tax cut. So he signed another tax cut besides the budget. I do know that there are some Democrats who may have tough races next fall, depending on how their districts turn out. They would like to know if the governor can sign that budget before they vote sometime end of June, because they'd also like to tout education investments and tax cuts in the reelection next fall. So it's an interesting dynamic. I'm kind of curious to watch how this game plays out, if there's really a path for Evers to veto the budget.
Yeah, let's move on now and start recapping the action from the Joint Finance Committee this week. Members approved a nearly $1.5 billion capital budget. Let's break it down a little bit here. Passed 11-4 is some $810 million less than what Evers sought in his $2.4 billion request. That request also included $1.95 billion in new bonding. Of that $1.5 billion total, JFC approved nearly $629 million in building projects for UW System. That's less than the $1 billion Evers sought. Among the projects not improved, we should mention $163 million for a new state office building in Milwaukee, $45 million for a new juvenile prison in Milwaukee County. JFC also voted to boost transportation spending by $357 million in the next 2 years, enumerate I-94 East-West in Milwaukee County, approve $700,000 to buy body cameras for State Patrol, and then in Thursday's meeting, lawmakers agreed to reauthorize the stewardship fund for just 4 years at $32 million annually. Evers had sought a 10-year reauthorization at $70 million annually. First two-day budget votes this week from JFC saw delays, you know, in both of those start times. A return to normalcy, it feels like, doesn't it, Jerry?
The joke in the room was it wasn't a real budget until that happened. Yeah. So it's honestly been the easiest finance process I've ever covered. Mm-hmm. They're doing everything in, they call them omnibus motions, where if you have an agency, they're going like spending line by spending line, you're doing it all in one shot, which limits debate, which Democrats aren't real thrilled about, but it speaks to the process. And they're not putting much in. If you look at all the motions, they're doing like little dabs of money here and there. There isn't a big flood of cash going to anything. It's keeping it fairly tight. There's not a lot of policy, if any. I mean, like there's one policy thing in the transportation motion to restrict spending on Lieutenant Governor Barnes's security detail. Otherwise, you're not seeing a lot of policy stuff because they don't want to give him fodder to rewrite it with his veto pen. So it's actually kind of going quickly.
What do you attribute the holdups to that we've seen this week? Obviously, stewardship was a big thing on Thursday. What about Tuesday?
Because you got to get to a deal. Mm. So, I mean, the revenue numbers came out on Tuesday, early morning. We caught Robin Voss outside of Lemon Hughes' office sometime early afternoon after finance had started, was supposed to start. So there was just, they wanted to talk about that. I don't know if it made a huge deal in the start time and like if it changed the transportation motion, for example. There always are a couple of hang-ups. There always delay things. But like yesterday with stewardship, they went into the day yesterday, from what I was told, on different wavelengths about stewardship, you know, where they wanted how many years and how much money. So it happens, you know, they're even though the same party, they're not always the same page of the party book.
Absolutely right. And we're going to talk about a little bit about the capital budget going in stocks, actually, with the Lincoln Hill stuff. So I'll save my commentary for that part of it. But actually, let's transition now. Let's hear from Senator Howard Markline, the JFC co-chair, and Representative Evan Goyke on that capital budget.
On this list, there are a lot of things that are not real sexy. Facility maintenance, utility repairs, preventative maintenance, capital equipment acquisition, you know, energy conservation, et cetera. Not sexy stuff, but things that need to get done. And we're making a significant investment in those kinds of maintenance things. I've always said you need to take care of what you have first before you build new. Again, I think this is a good capital projects budget. It's a responsible capital projects budget, and it's got my support.
You know, if you look at how to modernize and how to improve our juvenile justice system, there's really three legs to the stool. There's a mental health facility component, a local government component, and a state DOC component. And yet we cannot get the majority party to fund the damn thing. That's the last step that's left. It's not that difficult. And why would we move forward with Mendota and the county funding if you weren't willing to do the final piece of it? I mean, why would you go forward doing that if you weren't willing to finish the thing?
Assembly and Senate Republicans voted to end federal unemployment benefits this week. Both chambers signed off on a GOP bill to end Wisconsin's participation in federal programs to pay individuals an extra $300 per week in unemployment benefits. The payments come on top of the state's maximum weekly amount of $370. Evers told the Journal Sentinel he, quote, can't imagine he'll sign it. Senators also approved a bill to ban police from using chokeholds except in self-defense or life-threatening situations, and they advanced legislation to overhaul policies on absentee ballots and indefinitely confined voters. In the Assembly, lawmakers okayed a bill that would ensure federal law changes to restrict gun use couldn't be enforced in Wisconsin. Let's jump back, though, JR, to these election bills. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of interesting, I guess, developments on the Senate floor. SB 204 was ultimately passed, right? Senator Kathy Bernier, a former clerk, and Senator Rob Coles were the two Republicans to join all of their Democratic colleagues in voting against it. But there was some interesting amendment work where different provisions of bills mm-hmm. were all combined into that single one.
They took three bills and basically picked the parts that worked the best for some people and put it into one. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example. There are special voting deputies who go to assisted care facilities and help administer absentee ballots. There was a provision in one bill that was going to require clerks to survey, so they get 100 ballots from a nursing home facility, right? They have to survey 10% of those ballots and call the person and say, did you mean to cast this ballot? They want to make sure you're not being influenced by somebody. That would require clerks to survey 10% of ballots from each home that they get. It's a lot of work before election. That was not in the final, what they passed finally. There was another provision about indefinitely confined voters. If you are confined due to age, illness, infirmary, you can issue a declaration, sign a declaration with the local clerk and get a ballot sent to you under current law, basically going forward until you stop casting your ballot. There was going to be a requirement in this one Republican bill that if you're under 65, you had to basically get a note from your doctor to claim that status. Well, there are a lot of people who have a disability who are under 65 years old who can't get out. That's not a great look sometimes. So there are all these issues that kind of popped up in discussion. They stripped away some of the issues that weren't going to work, put them into one bill, passed it, knowing full well that's going to be vetoed anyway. But this is the better option than what they're looking at with a longer, more drawn-out discussion about the other bills.
Yeah, and all of this is a precursor to a marathon assembly floor session next week. Yes. We've got the vaccine passport bill, mm-hmm. I think, on the calendar at this point. What else have we got? The transgender athlete bills. What are you watching for in that, 14 hours that's reserved for debate next week?
Oh, there's all that. And then remember, there is a state convention for Republicans that last Saturday in June. They want to knock out all these bills for the good convention. They want to show we're doing these things because you're concerned about them. We're taking care of election problems that you think there are in Wisconsin because you care about them. We're hearing you. We're addressing it. There is a drive to get some of this stuff done, partly because of that, partly because the floor period ends in June. You know, after June, they're not supposed to be back until the fall, although they both agreed this week to add 2 weeks to the October floor period. So it could be a busy fall in Madison. But it's part of it getting, you know, sending a message to the base. We hear you. We hear you loud and clear. We're taking care of your issues.
Yep, absolutely. Let's hear a little bit from Wednesday's floor period in the State Assembly. Representative Shannon Zimmerman and Representative Francesca Hong will speak about the GOP bill to end the federal unemployment benefit in Wisconsin.
There was a time, certainly in this nation during the COVID pandemic, where this level of government support was absolutely warranted and necessary. We fast forward now to a time where we are exiting the pandemic situation materially, and now we have this unintended consequence where I do agree that certainly in the state of Wisconsin, and I've been an employer in the state of Wisconsin for over 25 years, that, you know, we had the high class problem of low unemployment, and we do have certainly a workforce issue. But that workforce issue has been exacerbated by the benefits now being provided, the incentives of staying at home. I see it in the hospitality industry. We see it in the healthcare industry, manufacturing, across the board. Our employers are begging for help. We do have a workforce crisis, as was previously noted. The very people that the government is trying to help, they're about to hurt, and here's why. You run up the debt this high, inflation's going to go up. Those very people will have spent their stimulus checks, and now prices for milk and for food and for everything else is higher. They will be harmed dramatically.
I haven't heard once us talk about the corporate welfare or the corporate tax cuts. The welfare that I believe many of my colleagues on the other side received this past year in the form of PPP loans. To speak as someone who in the past year has dealt with having to close down my business, having to hope that my employees would come back when I had to close my business, to now in recovery. I heard about crisis, I heard about emergency, and in the past 300 days when the COVID pandemic hit, not once were we talking about crisis and emergency then. There is a workforce shortage. We have a workforce crisis, absolutely. But if we are not speaking about the fact that people have been dealing with the pandemic for the past year, as an employer, as an employee, we should be looking at collective, comprehensive policies to move the state forward, to encourage communities to be stronger. And to say that we're out of touch with our workforce because we're advocating for them, I think there's a lot of work y'all have to do before you speak for workers.
Governor Tony Evers officially kicked off his reelection bid at the state Democratic Party convention this weekend. Evers told a virtual Democratic Party convention audience on Saturday he will seek a second term as Wisconsin's governor, calling himself, quote, the real education governor, a reference to a comment from former Governor Scott Walker. The former state superintendent warned what's at stake in next year's elections and called for using the moment to, quote, fix the big problems in Wisconsin and bounce back stronger than ever before. State GOP Chair Andrew Hitt said in response, quote, Evers has nothing to run on except a record of abysmal failure and absent leadership. The announcement comes in the days after his campaign unveiled four new hires. Evers, I should also note, finished 2020 with $3.4 million in the bank. Themes Evers touched on, JR, in his speech announcing his reelection. What did he hit on? What's he clearly planning on running on? And did he try to shore up any areas of potential weakness?
Republicans aren't working with him. He's all standing in the way of their bad bills, roads, schools, health care. Sounds a lot like we heard 2018. Look, governor, he's got three big vulnerabilities, right? One, unemployment insurance problems with getting claims processed during the pandemic. Two, his handling of Kenosha and the violent protests there, the wake of the shooting of Jacob Blake. And three, there's a Democrat in the White House. The party in power in the White House struggles in midterm elections in Wisconsin, and it has for the last 16 years. It's not easy. So those are his challenges. His pluses, his priorities are popular. Expanding Medicaid, legalizing marijuana, investing in schools, fixing roads, people like that stuff. The to be determined is the COVID response. It's a little polarizing right now. The last polls we saw from Marquette had him in the plus territory for what he had done, but now we're kind of post-pandemic. I haven't seen a poll from Marquette since October, so I'm not sure where he's at with these things. So it'll be interesting how that plays out. What he has to do between now and next fall is present a positive, forward-looking vision about what he wants to do. It's not just to say Republicans are bad, don't let them take over because these bad things will happen. You got to have more than that because it's not just about Democrats, it's about the middle too. So it'll be interesting to watch how he develops that message and what his theme is going to be going into next fall.
Yep. Let's hear directly from Governor Evers' announcement from the DPW convention on Saturday.
There's one more thing I have to say tonight.
One more thing? What would that be, Governor?
Wisconsin, I'm in. I'm running for re-election. We've accomplished a lot in the last few years, but we're just getting started. We have more work to do together. This is a moment when we can choose to fix the big problems in Wisconsin and bounce back stronger than ever before. That means doing what's best for our kids, creating good paying jobs, fixing our infrastructure, supporting small businesses, and making sure everyone has access to quality, affordable healthcare. All the things we want for our state. We have 521 days to make it happen, folks, and I'm going to need your help to do it. But I know because of all of you watching tonight, we're going to win. So let's get to work, folks.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled local health officials can't close schools in public health emergencies. The consolidated case centered around a Dane County emergency order that closed all schools in the area for in-person instruction in grades 3 through 12. Because Madison Public Schools and other public schools in the county had largely decided to begin the school year virtually, the order would have applied largely just to private ones. The Supreme Court decision, released Friday morning, also found the move violated petitioners' quote, fundamental constitutional right to the free exercise of religion. But the court's liberal minority argued that the constitutional analysis was unnecessary and wholly beside the point because the case could be resolved on statutory grounds. The order was first issued last August, though the court placed a hold on it in September. Oral arguments were heard in December, and of course the decision came just as the school year is about to wrap up. JR, you've spoken before about the interesting discussions that yes. our justices get into in the footnotes. We saw some of those today in the decision from the majority. Can you sort of summarize that for us?
It's about the role of the courts in handling disputes. And Rebecca Dallet, a liberal justice, basically argued that there should be a more restrained role, that like what you said about if there's a chance to resolve other ways, we should not do that. Rebecca Bradley, a conservative, is like, no, we are the bulwark of against infringement on justice and rights. We have to be aggressive. We should not be modest in expressing our authority. And Brian Hagedorn, it's really interesting. So remember, Hagedorn and Bradley have had a couple of feuds in their footnotes over the last year. Even though they're both conservatives in the court, they're not the same kind of strain of conservatism, I guess I put it nicely. And Hagedorn wrote a concurring opinion saying, I agree with everything in the majority opinion, except the footnote about the role of the court in these decisions. It should be more modest. Rebecca Bradley took both him and Dowd to task in her footnote about how they misunderstand the role of the courts and accused Rebecca Dowd of misquoting another opinion, by the way. And Hagedorn took great lengths to go in his own concurring opinion note, I agree with everything except for that footnote. And because I don't accept that footnote, her opinion about the court's role in citing issues is not controlling. It's just kind of, you know, behind-the-scenes court drama, but tells you that there's just a little bit of some spice sometimes, these decisions, if you're a dork like I am and read everything, including the footnotes.
It's always worth reading the footnotes, as we've learned, especially recently. But anyway, let's move on to stocks now, Jared. What's rising this week?
The Dem Senate primary. So at convention last week, Mark Pocan had a message to everybody running for U.S. Senate Democratic side, which there are a lot of them right now. Let's play nice. Let's keep focused on Ron Johnson. Don't think that's going to happen. This week there was a story about Alex Lazary and his claims about how they embraced $15 an hour for employees of the Buck Stadium, right? This taxpayer-financed arena. Turns out it wasn't necessarily 100% accurate. They weren't right at $15 an hour from day one. It took a while to get there. So you're seeing like the first swings kind of coming out. And now look, Lazary's got personal wealth, that's going to be a plus and a minus. Sarah Galuski has personal wealth, be a plus and a minus. Tom Nelson's been whacking away at these guys that, you know, he's not the wealthy candidate, he's a more modest means person. Chris Larson is now in state senator. He's whacking away at Lazary. He's also a Milwaukee candidate. He's got to try and, you know, you talk about those lanes again, right? What's Larson's lane? Milwaukee. Lazary's a Milwaukee candidate. You try and get some Milwaukee. It's inevitable there's going to be some fights between now and next August. The question is, how ugly does it get? And does it help Ron Johnson or the Republican who runs in Ron Johnson's place if Johnson seeks re-election?
Yep. And what's mixed this week?
So the 37th AD fundraising, I read all the finance reports, the dork that I am. I know. It's fascinating. Here you have a special election on Tuesday, which nobody is talking about, by the way, special for assembly seat in Watertown, basically Watertown area. What I saw was that they're not raising a big balance of money, and what they are raising a lot is from their own pockets. So it's interesting to note that there isn't a lot. There isn't much radio. There isn't TV. So I saw no radio, no TV. I saw some mail and some billboards, but not a lot of attention. The question becomes, how do you win that primary, a low turnout election on Tuesday, with nothing else on the ballot? The answer might be shoe leather. So it might not matter how much they've raised or how much they put their own money in, but how many doors do they hit? And more importantly, do they do the right number of doors, the right doors? There are certain voters who turn out every election. I'm one of them, although I don't vote for either party most of the time and write my wife in for governor or president. That's Clyde's point. But there are some voters who turn out every election, right? Those are Republicans you want to target. You know they're going to turn out on Tuesday. How do you find them? How do you reach them? How do you get them out? Those are the challenges for these guys to try and figure out between now and Tuesday, because that could go long to determine who's going to win that primary and be heavily favored to win that seat in July.
Absolutely. And what's falling this week, Jared?
So Lincoln Hills, look, 3 years ago, Republicans couldn't move fast enough to close Lincoln Hills. It was a problem for Scott Walker in his reelection bid. There were all these bad headlines about what was going on up there with the youth who were incarcerated there, all kinds of incidents with staff. Fast forward to now, and they pass up doing $45 million to build this new youth facility in Milwaukee, do $4 million to study it and plan it, and don't enumerate it. Enumerating it means you can actually go ahead with the project. Without enumeration, you can't do it. Now, there are a couple of things going on. One, the attention's kind of faded. It's not where it was before. Two, there's a different governor. So it's now Evers' problem, not Walker's problem. So there's some cynics in the Capitol who think that this is a little bit of a political thing where they're saying, hey, we're not feeling pressure. It's Evers to deal with. We're not going to be in a rush. And three, Republicans who care about it, and there are some who care deeply about this, there aren't great numbers because they're usually in that area or they care deeply about prison policy. That's not a majority of the Republican caucuses. So the drive has gone away. Now, there's always a possibility to pass a different bill to get it done. But this is a piece of the three-pronged approach to replacing Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. Number one, you have to have a new Type 1 facility basically house the worst offenders. This is the Milwaukee one. Two, you expand Mendota, which is a juvenile facility and an adult facility, but has capable of treating people who have mental health problems. Once that expansion goes forward, and it's approved in the joint finance version of the budget so far, for the first time in Wisconsin, we can treat female inmates who have mental health orders who are minors. That's huge. Third is the county-run facilities to house medium-level offenders, okay? Right now, we only have one. Going forward, Racine County. This entire process has been a little bit flawed from the start because the rush to try and get it done 3 years ago, they underfunded it. They set an artificial deadline that wasn't realistic. They pushed it back already once on July 1st this year, which is not going to happen, by the way. And now the question is, okay, what happens with Milwaukee? Don't forget, once there's a new facility, there may be more of a openness to send kids there. The population dropped down to fewer than 60, I think, last check I got from Department of Corrections at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. That's down a lot. Once there's a new facility, though, you may see more kids go. You may need a second facility. And let's not take the blame all off the Evers administration. They totally dropped the ball in trying to find a place for Milwaukee the first time. So recall, there was a push for two Type 1 facilities a couple of years ago, one in Milwaukee, one in the Fox Valley. The Evers folks and corrections officials didn't do their homework in talking to locals. The people up in the Fox Valley went nuts about where they wanted to put it, and that was nixed. And the Milwaukee folks were not happy about it either, that not in my backyard thing, right? So we are stuck in a position where even on the governor's budget, if passed as is, Lincoln Hills couldn't close until 2024 when the new facility opens. I don't know that that timeline would work with what's going on right now, and likely it won't.
And I think the only thing I would add to that very great summary is the fact that we are still coming up on this July 1st, 2021 statutory deadline by which DOC is supposed to close Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake. There's a possibility that after that date, youth being housed there start suing because they shouldn't be, in their minds, right, housed in a facility that's supposed to be closed, right? So we could see lawsuits coming in the coming weeks and months. There's also an issue about youth placements, right, for these very serious juvenile offenders. Will judges be inclined to place youth in a Type 1 facility, the only Type 1 facility that's open currently in the state, even though statutorily it's not supposed to be opened, right? But there's no other Type 1 alternative. So what are judges going to do? There's a lot of fascinating stuff happening in the short and medium term that we'll have to keep an eye on going forward.
And don't forget, the kids who are up there and the staff are stuck in the middle. It's not just like the kids are the only ones to worry about. Staff also have been in a difficult position for a while. So there are people, real lives at stake in this whole discussion.
Exactly. I'm glad we brought it back to the real life implications. Thanks for doing that, JR, and thanks everyone for tuning in. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm JR Ross.
And that's Rewind for June 11th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.